Right now, it is time to bring in David Terachuk with the Media Beat. Of course, you can find David right here live on a Friday. We broadcast on Monday right after the 12 noon news. Also, you can hear him on the weekend online at robinhoodradio.com, on demand, whenever you'd like. And, of course, he's got his own website. That's right, themediabeat.us. And on top of all of that, he's a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. Okay, David, show's over.
I was just going to say, not to mention...
Good morning. Are we done now?
Yes, we are. Not to mention a really decent guy.
That's right.
I said,
you know, I'm going to take the opportunity of that wonderful drum roll to say that I'm going to declare this day an open day. I've just been noticed. I don't know if you notice in the media generally, there's a huge new slew of openness over the last few days. Special Prosecutor Mueller's team, normally so tight-lipped, is suddenly getting less tight-lipped, even a little bit open, letting stuff out into the press, saying how unhappy they are about how Attorney General Barr has not really represented their findings fully and accurate. Well, of course, it was never meant to be fully, but in fact, they're suggesting now, anonymously, in that time-honored way, that we'll get to journalists and out into the public prints and the public digital space as well, saying that their work has been totally mischaracterized. And President Trump's former personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, is getting even more open now and willing to talk of newly found examples of Trumpian malfeasance and show newly found files to the committees in Congress that are really anxious to keep working with him before he goes to jail. And even President Trump, despite threats about closing the border, is now leaving the border open. This is open day, I keep telling you. And Boeing, the aerospace corporation, getting more open now, at least, though it wasn't before.
You want a software upgrade?
Faulty software.
Yeah, we've been
to pay extra for that.
It will take more than a software upgrade. There's something very wrong with their safety software for the 737 MAX. Whole new regime of openness.
We've got a local angle on that Boeing story. Ralph Nader, who lives in Winsted, Connecticut, one of his family members was on
his
that
great
plane.
Niece.
His niece. And
great niece.
And he has filed a wrongful death suit against Boeing. And he's the first one.
Unsafe at any speed.
Yeah,
the best title he came up for his work.
I'll tell you,
sadly enough, it's true here too.
Yeah, the airline industry is going to rue the day that he gets involved.
That's right,
in their safety.
And I have to say, this is a personal opinion, but he was on All Things Considered yesterday afternoon, giving an absolute clinic in how you speak about something to and it was most impressive, and I encourage anybody to listen to it was the afternoon about in the 5 o'clock hour on All Things Considered.
I don't know, David, if you've ever spoken to him, but we've spoken to him several times, and he is just, whether or not you agree with his politics or his findings, he is one of the most engaging and well-spoken people I've ever talked to. And you know what? The man just never seems to get old.
And the main thing,
I have noticed, yes.
But the main thing is he is direct and he is sensible and he knows what the parameters are. And he actually forces the people that he is speaking to think between those lines. And that's what was
sure.
most interesting.
It's a great clarity of expression, which I've admired too. You know, I was in a kind of aviation clinic yesterday too. I was at a conference about the future. It was actually called Designing Our Future, one of those sort of amusing titles for crystal ball gazing that always gets me with futurists and the rest. The idea that we can actually plan our future. I mean, to some degree, of course, we can, and there are all sorts of areas in which you can plot things forward. And I was actually in a an aviation session where engineers and pilots were in the panel. And interestingly, there was a fourth person on the panel, a moderator. He was the only male on the panel. All three of these aviation people were female. That in itself was striking. It shouldn't be, of course, because women are scattered, and I'm afraid still a little scattered throughout that industry. But once upon a time, it would have been a complete rarity. So that was encouraging. And one of the women was not just an engineer, but an active pilot in the Royal Air Force. This was had a very British skew to it, this whole conference. She was a member of the Royal Air Force, flight lieutenant by rank, and actually flying the British equivalent of the Thunderbirds and the Blue Angels in this country. In Britain, the RAF fly this extraordinary formation aerobatics team called the Red Arrows. And she is one of this flight lieutenant is one of those pilots. And all three of the women, the other two were engineers and industry executives. They were very clear themselves. They gave something of a clinic about what exactly was clearly wrong, just from the reported evidence so far with the 737 MAX's so-called safety measures, very clear about the need for a balance between technical fixes and the capacity for humans to override faulty technology as well, which is what lies at the heart of this terrible trouble with that particular model.
And that was very much Mr. Nader's point to the hostess, speaking of women, on All Things Considered, which is there's got to be a balance. He said you are going to be seeing this in all industries, because if you give everything over to autonomous, you are going to see that there is relying on all autonomous is inefficient. There is a place and a balance for human and technology.
They call it artificial intelligence, and we have to always remember that there is an artificial in there.
Yeah.
And that very word is the giveaway, which we must always be cautious about.
I want to go back to another story and see what your viewing is as a media observer. As I have over the past couple of days, you can't get away from it sitting here listening to the news on NPR and BBC, and then going home and watching probably 10 to 15 minutes a day of news. One thing has come out after this Mueller report has come out, and nobody has mentioned this on the networks at all, and that is the source of these people that are very upset with the Mueller report that worked on it, okay, the people that worked for Mueller. No one has brought up the fact that I don't think these people would be speaking unless the man himself was upset and he knows that he can't come out himself and he is, you know.
No, that was somebody said that. Yeah, people talk about that, but the fact is that he, whatever. That has come up.
It is extraordinarily significant that this team, which never let anything leak out of itself for a whole 2 years and more, and indeed when they felt that anything was being misreported only once, for clearly very important reasons, decided to just limit the come out set well. Publicly with a statement and say that, hey, someone's got ahead of the story out there already and correcting the record as it went along. These guys are clearly stickler for procedure and sticklers for truth, too. So the very fact that this sudden seepage has started to happen is extreme. I mean, it silence speaks volume sometimes. Just a little bit of speaking after complete silence betokens an awful lot. And that lot, I suggest, is that, yes, the man who has kept a very tight rein on this very tight ship for 2.5 years has been loosening that rein right now.
You know,
and he must have very good reason for doing that.
It's interesting because I think when he filed his report, no one's really seen it except for the Attorney General and maybe one of the president's lawyers. Who knows?
But apparently not. The case of the White House.
Yeah. But I think that when Barr became the Attorney General, the Mueller figured that he gives him the report, then is up to the Congress to decide what to do with it from there.
But isn't that why Rosenstein stayed on?
Yeah, but Rosenstein backed down and supported that letter that was written by Barr. And so I think he was leaving, and then he stayed. I think this is a way to force this report to go in secret to some committee on the House. I don't think it's going to be all wide open for the public. I think eventually a lot will come out to the public. But I think that it's eventually, because of what you're hearing now, it will go to the Congress in its full form with some redactions for the Congress to take a look at it.
Okay. Yes, that's the way it's heading now. That seems pretty clear.
Yep.
The one background note that one needs to take into account here, too, is that Barr has clearly got an approach which he's talked about himself, and indeed it's probably why he got the job in the first place. He's talked of the need for a particular kind of executive authority, which is automatically going to side with the president in a case like this, and as I say, that helped him get the job in the first place. And on the other hand, Mueller has shown no compunction about going as far as he possibly can into investigating the president himself. That was part of his brief, and he took it very seriously. He tried to sit down with Trump in a face-to-face interview, and of course, all Trump's protectors insisted that shouldn't happen. So you got two very different attitudes from these two individuals. But as individuals, it has to be said, and this is the background note I want to stress, is that they've known each other for years. Their families are good friends with each other.
Quite right.
There's a case here of mutual respect going on, even if they are very different people in terms of their outlook upon the president's authority.
I'm so glad you raised that, because in more cases than not, something that reporters know, even if they sit on TV, journalists, whatever you want, and opinionate, they actually know who knows who and how long they've known them for. And there was a similar thing with Kavanaugh during the Kavanaugh hearings. There are personal relationships that exist, but they are presented to the consumer as though there's a Chinese wall there. And
good journalists will sketch in that. It's not necessarily a foreground matter, but people are capable of being professional with each other, even when they may have certain personal relations, good or bad. But in this case, it is known that they have good relations. But clearly, they are, just reading the runes, it seems very clear that they have very different approaches to what this report has to say.
And then there was another piece that I was just fascinated by. And I had to go back and see if I had dreamt it just because of the presentation. And that was that, and I think it was initially reported in the Wall Street Journal, that 3 weeks before, that Mueller had told Justice Department officials, I don't know when Barr came on, so someone had to know, certainly Rosenstein had to know, before submitting the report, that they were not going to conclude They were not going to reach a conclusion on obstruction.
It wasn't up to him.
Well, you could read that as being on the cards from the very beginning. He wasn't under any obligation to reach a conclusion. In fact, he was presenting evidence.
He was not
to the Justice Department, but destined for Congress. I mean, that was clear from the very beginning.
This was not like the special prosecutor with Bill Clinton. He could actually bring up charges and stuff.
What he
did was absolutely what he was hired to do, present a whole bunch of facts and what went on, and then let Congress decide from there whether or not to move forward. Basically, that's exactly what he did.
Except that in practice, what he ended up doing is presenting such a slew of evidence and in such one might think uncalled for detail, salacious detail at that. That it was very clear what kind of report he was presenting. It was he was out to defame and derogate. Derogatory evidence was piled upon derogatory evidence, and no actual proposition for a legal remedy. That's not what you normally expect from a prosecutor, except in this case he was perfectly within his rights to do it as a special prosecutor with the brief he had. But of course it just smelled to high heaven of an attempt to
cover up,
to pull down the president.
Now, we can't let you get away in the last 8 or 9 minutes without bringing in Theresa May, Jeremy Corbyn, Brexit, British Parliament.
My sister and I, both of us Brits in exile, have been trying to build what we call a Brexit-free zone around ourselves, but it doesn't work. In fact, she's back in England now, giving me reports. I want to get, just before we go to Brexit, and I'm not trying to put off the awful moment. I really am not. I'm very prepared to talk about it. But just before we get there, I want to share with you something my sister shared with me. She's a big fan of your show, by the way, and your station overall, a supporter of it, I believe. But she sent me a note about German Chancellor Angela Merkel being in Ireland, and this has not been reported very much in the American media. And
true.
You'd think, well, of course not, it wouldn't be.
Except that it happened.
And I guess that's fair enough. But it's very interesting over there, talking about the effect of Brexit on the Irish border between the Irish Republic and that part of the Irish Island. Which still remains in British hands, the province of Northern Ireland, the whole sort of specter of that border over which a virtual civil war was fought for 30 years and thousands of people lost their lives, which ended with the peace agreement 20 years ago under Tony Blair, negotiated by with enormous American help, it has to be said, Bill Clinton and the former leader of the Senate, George Mitchell, had a great influence on ending that terrible violence and creating a peace agreement. But now it's under threat, that whole peace arrangement, because of Brexit sort of raising the specter, as I say, of a hard border between these two parts of Ireland again. And Angela Merkel said something extraordinary for an overseas visitor. Not known, I don't think, in the wider world for a particularly strong, empathetic strain to her character. She's a tough lady. But she said it was very interesting to meet people along the border and to recognize how much concern is stirred up by the prospect of this becoming a hard border again and possibly under violent dispute. She said that coming from Germany, she really understood the importance of borders. And of course, their threatening nature to human, for peaceful human activity. So that was something that hasn't been reported much in America, but I thought I'd pass it on.
Right, and it's just a reminder because of history, and you've got a bunch of people running around who might have pieces of the Berlin Wall, but don't have any sense really of what the separation across the border was like.
Sure. Yeah.
Now, getting back to the
Brexit,
the heart of Brexit,
the possible marriage of some sort of intertwining of Corbyn and May and all the everything else really is itself. Even every day, it's kind of like the Donald Trump presidency. Every day, you think nothing else worse can happen, but in Brexit, it's happening.
There's always some new twist, and it's usually for the worse. Yeah. Yes.
But what's also frustrating is it's very difficult to pick apart the thread of the information. It's very difficult to follow the thread of the information because it keeps getting twisted. It's really hard to get raw data that can actually be analyzed, and that's a fundamental personal frustration. So you hear this, or you hear that, or you hear the other, but it's like having a beautiful ornaments and no Christmas tree.
Well, Marshall, you sort of get to the heart of the current sort of degree of extraordinariness that it's gotten to, and you put those two names together, right. Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn. The leader of the Labour Party, the opposition party. Now, again, it's another process that has been going on for over 2 years, the referendum by the Brits in which they decided by a small majority, but a majority, that they wanted to leave Europe was 2 and a bit years ago. And since then, Theresa May has been pushing for a way to get legislation passed that would authorize and permit their exit from Europe, as she said she would do, because that's what the public wanted, and she's stuck to that line all along. But the one other thing she could have done from the beginning, knowing that her own party was divided on this issue, was to reach out to the other side. Yeah. And there are many people in Parliament who thought that would have been a very sensible idea. And she resisted and resisted and resisted. And only now, when it's absolute crunch time, past crunch time, in fact, and we're getting extensions to crunch time now, only now is she prepared to talk to the other side. And apparently not that openly either. She's not giving up much. When it comes to having negotiations with the Labour Party on a parliamentary basis now. So it's another reflection on how obdurate the whole process has been, mainly because the Prime Minister herself has been obdurate.
Yeah. And the other thing that's not mentioned nearly enough is how the EU is playing their hand, because they're... they're setting their own examples, and not just with... the UK, but with anyone who might be foolish enough to say, you know, we want to go too.
Well, that's the whole thing. I think.
Well, if you're a club and you have members of that club, if people want to leave it, well, are you going to be generous to them? Probably not. But the whole point in having a club in the first place is to carve out some advantages for everybody to be members, and that means that you get disadvantages if you leave.
I'm not commenting. I'm simply.
I'm not
arguing either. I'm just saying this is so blindingly obvious that I don't know why people don't see why.
I understand.
I just some kind of anomaly.
I just think that the EU has handled themselves actually with great restraint in this, because
it could have been an awful lot.
Absolutely. It's bad enough as it is, but they've handled it with enough restraint. Let's see if they can keep the restraint going for another 2 weeks.
It's making them. This is all part of the big, bigger picture. It's making them look, incredibly responsible. Yeah. Because again, you've got the two parties, but then there are numerous. I mean, you don't have just the two parties, but you've got Corbyn and you've got May, and then because they're speaking, it doesn't give people don't understand how many. Members they have to deal with.
And divisions are amongst those members. Yes, absolutely.
That was the rest of the sentence. Many of whom have slight. It's not that it's easy to say, okay, we've got a 75% majority in this group, and so sorry about your luck, everybody else. Oh no, you've just got just. It's like a bag of cat litter.
Yeah, it's Europe is. Europe has been an issue for Britain, a contentious issue ever since the whole idea was raised that we go into it,
right.
Go into the what was then called the common market. I remember that was its origins. It was a common market. It was a market area in which there would clearly be advantages. Well, so many advantages in going in, but it was a hard-fought battle when we went in 1974, if I'm remembering the date right, under Prime Minister Ted Heath, who was a rampant Europhile and much attacked for that amongst the right wing of his Conservative Party. Now his successor, several generations down, Theresa May was kind of a pro-European until she decided that she would take the lead of the party once her predecessor messed up so badly by having the idea of a referendum in the first place, which totally boomeranged on him. David Cameron, I'm talking about. So all the way along, there have been tensions pulling people who wanted to be in Europe out of it, because there's been this very strong core of resistance in Britain to ever being members of Europe in the first place.
I have to say this, and I wish I didn't. Thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, The Media Beat.
Thank you.